Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 86 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update from the Recording Library of West Texas for Friday, September 25th, 2020. I'm Michael, and here are some of the stories we'll be reading today. Republican dissent over Texas Governor Greg Abbott's pandemic response animates state Senate special election. Most coronavirus cases among Texas public school students found in teenagers, data shows. Worried that flu season and coronavirus pandemic could overwhelm hospitals, health officials urge Texans to get flu shots. Health expert Peter Hotez warns of a third COVID-19 wave, says a vaccine likely won't come for another year. U.S. still in the first COVID-19 wave and should be prepared for challenge of fall and winter, Fauci says. What the 1918 flu pandemic can teach us about coronavirus. Will the public trust a COVID-19 vaccine? The pandemic pushes hundreds of millions of people towards starvation and poverty. Those are some of the articles we'll be reading this afternoon. First, let's look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,752. Ector County negative, 22,250 out of 27,328 tested, with 326 pending, 97 deaths. Recovered, 4,032. Active, 623. Midland County, 3,636 confirmed, 82 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, Texas surpasses 15,000 coronavirus deaths as cases and hospitalizations remain below July's record highs. 3,204 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 24th, 42 less than a week ago. They occupy 5.5% of hospital beds. 3,840 new cases were reported on September 24th. The latest positivity rate is 6.35%. 15,267 Texans have died as of September 24th. 138 more deaths reported than the day before, and 677 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $40.07, down 22 cents. Now here are coronavirus briefs. The U.S. is nearing 7 million coronavirus cases. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Ensemble forecast now projects there will be up to 226,000 coronavirus deaths in the United States by October 17th. Tokyo 2020 organizers want fewer people to travel to the Olympics next year. A large proportion of the U.S. population will not be vaccinated against the novel coronavirus this year, Dr. Fauci said during a Facebook Live event Thursday. United to be the first U.S. airline to offer coronavirus tests for passengers. Rio's Carnival delayed for first time in over a century. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi moved to assemble a new coronavirus relief bill Thursday, abruptly shifting course to form the basis for renewed talks with the White House. China reports asymptomatic cases in port workers who dealt with seafood. Data shows that only about 100 children and teenagers have died of COVID-19 in the United States, a fatality rate that is drawing wonder from clinicians and increasing interest among researchers hoping to understand why. Now here are some short stories. Fauci says most Americans who will not be vaccinated this year must continue with other health measures. Even if there were an effective vaccine in place, Americans would need to continue to wear masks and observe social distancing, Dr. Fauci said Thursday. It is not going to eliminate the need to be prudent and careful with our public health measures, he told New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy during a Facebook Live conversation. Fauci also said that a large proportion of the U.S. population will not be vaccinated against the novel coronavirus this year, challenging the repeated assertions from President Trump that a vaccine will be ready by Election Day. As the Washington Post has reported, the Food and Drug Administration's tough new standard for an emergency approval of a coronavirus vaccine will make it exceedingly difficult for any vaccine to be cleared before the November election. On Wednesday, President Trump said the FDA plan sounds like a political move, warning that the White House might reject it, even as four of his administration's top health officials have insisted that politics would not seep into the vaccine approval process. But according to Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, that timeline might not be as decisive as others are making it out to be, because not everyone will receive the vaccine, and it will not be effective in all of those who get it. There will still be plenty of room for the virus to spread. I think if we can get 75 to 80% of the population vaccinated, I think that would be a really good accomplishment, he said. Besides, he added, masks can protect from aerosol transmission, which many scientists say can occur with the novel coronavirus. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is updating its guidance on this matter, the agency said, after pulling recommendations that had erroneously made it online last week. Growing skepticism in potential COVID-19 vaccine is an enormous problem, health expert says. Growing skepticism about a potential COVID-19 vaccine is an enormous problem, Dr. William Schaffner, a professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, said Thursday on CNN. It's a big problem, Schaffner told CNN's Aaron Burnett, because once we do develop a vaccine, obviously we want people to accept it, but there's growing skepticism in the general population. Recent polls have shown many Americans say they won't get a coronavirus vaccine. But what's not represented in this skepticism and the concern in the medical profession, said Schaffner, a liaison to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. They are very concerned. I hear that almost literally every single day. So if physicians won't recommend it once it comes out, when they recommend caution, that will just hamper the vaccination program, he said. Reputational damage. Schaffner also said the reputation of both the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the CDC are tainted because of political interference. I'm worried, he said. Both the reputation of the FDA and the CDC, unfortunately, have been tainted because of political interference, and even just this recent FDA wishing to change the ground rules for the development of the vaccine has to go to the White House for approval, that's totally inappropriate, he said. It's never happened before, should not happen. That's evidence of political interference with a basic scientific process, Schaffner said. President Trump said Wednesday that the White House could override the FDA if the agency released tougher standards for the authorization of a COVID-19 vaccine, calling such a move political. The FDA is considering new coronavirus vaccine guidelines that would make it unlikely a COVID-19 vaccine could be authorized or approved by Election Day, a timeline Trump has repeatedly openly pushed for. Trump's decision to withdraw from WHO will hurt the U.S., Director General says. The Trump administration's decision to withdraw from the World Health Organization will hurt the United States, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said in an interview with Time posted Thursday. Withdrawing from the WHO actually hurts the U.S. because being part of the WHO is not just to help those who need support, said Tedros. The U.S. also benefits from being a member of WHO. Tedros told Time that when he first heard that the United States was withdrawing from WHO, he didn't believe it. He said he had a very cordial conversation with U.S. President Donald Trump on March 23rd, in which there was no hint that the U.S. was planning a withdrawal. Even now, I believe that the U.S. administration doesn't have any good reason to withdraw from WHO, said Tedros. And that's my strong position. No good reason. Tedros said the consequences of the decision are still unclear. I don't see the membership or the relationship with the U.S. as a financial transaction. It's not the money which matters. It's actually the global leadership of the U.S., Tedros said. He noted that when battling the coronavirus pandemic, nations are stronger together. One of the impacts which may be visible is, you know, the global solidarity is weak. Major global powers are not working together, Tedros said. Here's a follow-up article on something that we read about a few weeks ago. Helsinki Airport deploys sniffer dogs to detect COVID-19. A group of sniffer dogs trained to detect COVID-19 have begun working at Helsinki Airport in Finland in an effort to identify those who have contracted the virus. We are among the pioneers. As far as we know, no other airport has attempted to use canine scent detection on such a large scale against COVID-19. Airport Director Yula Letajev said in a statement, "This might be an additional step forward on the way to beating COVID-19. Finnish startup Wise Nose has trained a total of 10 dogs, which will work in shifts of 4 to sniff out the coronavirus. The process involves those being tested swiping their skin with a test wipe and dropping it into a cup, which is then given to the dog that sniffs it. The dog and its handler are held in a separate booth during the test. If the test result is positive, the individual will be directed to a health information point inside the airport. All of the tests are processed anonymously," Helsinki Airport said. The dogs can smell the virus with almost 100% certainty and can identify the virus days before the symptoms have started, the airport said, citing preliminary tests conducted by a research group at the veterinary facility of the University of Helsinki. "We have solid experience in training disease-related scent detection dogs. It was fantastic to see how fast the dogs took to the new smell," said Anna Heilm Bjortman, a University of Helsinki clinical instructor leading the research group. Now we'll go to a few articles from the Texas Tribune. In the interest of time, I will be condensing these articles. Republican dissent over Texas Governor Greg Abbott's pandemic response animates state Senate special election. Governor Greg Abbott may not be on the ballot this fall, but his response to the coronavirus pandemic, maligned as overreach by some in his own party, is reverberating through a special election for a Texas Senate seat. In the race to replace Senator Pat Fallon, Republican Prosper, the intra-party reckoning is being forced by Shelley Luther, the Dallas salon owner who was jailed this year over her refusal to shut down her business due to coronavirus restrictions. Tuesday's special election is unfolding in safely red rural territory, the kind of place where conservative angst toward Abbott has risen amid the pandemic, even as the state's Republicans try to keep their ranks focused on a momentous November 3rd general election. Campaigning Tuesday evening in this town about 70 miles southwest of Fort Worth, Luther peppered her stump speech with criticism of Abbott's handling of the pandemic. She said, "Our tyrant governor has embarrassed us completely with business shutdowns due to the coronavirus." As she boasted of her efforts in defiance of coronavirus restrictions, she scoffed at more traditional politicians who pushed back in less dramatic ways. "What did they do when Texas was shut down?" she said. "They said, 'Oh, I wrote a letter,' or 'I, what? Wrote a letter?'" "If we need to open Texas," she added, "as soon as I'm elected, you watch how quickly it opens, because it's going to be on." Luther faces 5 special election opponents, including State Representative Drew Springer, Republican Munster. He started the race in a strong position, but has had to increasingly confront an unconventional foe in Luther as she leans into her political outsider status and pitches herself as a more forceful agitator against Abbott's pandemic management. "From the standpoint of Let's Open Texas, I think, honestly, out of all five Republican candidates, we're all on the same boat, Springer told the Texas Tribune. We should be fully open right now, 100%. Now I'll stop at this point in the article and go to our next. Most coronavirus cases among Texas public school students found in teenagers, data shows. The vast majority of known coronavirus cases among Texas public school students who have returned to classrooms in person this school year were found in older students, new state data released Thursday shows. According to the data, which includes self-reported, test-confirmed cases from hundreds of school districts across the state, 69% of infected students were in grades 7 through 12, while just 15% were in grades 4 through 6, and 16% in grades 3 or lower. Experts say that split makes sense, since there is some evidence that older students are more likely to be symptomatic and thus more likely to be tested. Statewide, at least 3,735 Texas public school students who have returned to campus in person this school year have tested positive for the coronavirus, less than 1% of students who are learning in person, according to enrollment estimates from the Texas Education Agency. Now, once again, stopping at this point and moving to the next article. Worried that flu season and coronavirus pandemic could overwhelm hospitals, health officials urge Texans to get flu shots. Flu season starts in October, overlapping with the coronavirus pandemic that continues to rage across the state and the country. At the same time, thousands more Texas school children are scheduled to return to the classroom next month. This combination, Texas health officials warn, could be a recipe for an unprecedented health disaster, but one they hope can be mitigated if people get their annual flu shots. If we have a bad flu season and fill up our emergency rooms, our ICU beds, and our hospital beds with flu patients, we're not going to be able to defend ourselves against the onslaught of the coronavirus, said John Carlo, a member of the Texas Medical Association COVID-19 Task Force and past chair of the Texas Public Health Coalition. While COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations are trending downward in the state, experts are still waiting to see whether the recent Labor Day weekend and students returning to in-person instruction will lead to another surge in hospitalizations. Health officials worry that a bad flu season on top of the pandemic could lead to COVID-19 testing shortages, strain hospital capacity, and create further complications for school campuses. What's worse is that doctors still don't know what a person catching both the novel coronavirus and flu at the same time might look like. Meanwhile, some experts are keeping their fingers crossed that increased personal hygiene practices adopted during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic could keep the worst of the flu season at bay. Get a flu shot. In August, Governor Greg Abbott said the upcoming flu season could be prolific and urged Texans to understand the importance of getting ahead of the curve and getting vaccinated. If that leads to greater hospitalizations, coupled with the hospitalizations that we're seeing for COVID-19, you can easily see how hospitals in this region, as well as across Texas, will be completely overrun with an inability for the hospitals to take care of the medical needs of everybody in the entire region, Abbott said at a press conference that followed a roundtable discussion with medical professionals in Dallas. Carlo said the U.S. has an unfortunately really low flu vaccination rate. In Texas, an estimated 43.2% of adults and 61.8% of children were immunized in the 2018-19 flu season, according to the National Immunization Survey. He said this year, the flu vaccine could also protect people from a severe outcome of having both the flu and COVID-19 at the same time. Angela Clendenin, an epidemiologist and biostatistician at the Texas A&M University School of Public Health, said the flu vaccine is typically 40 to 60% effective. The big misconception is when people go and get the flu shot and then they end up getting the flu and they think that it failed, and that the flu vaccination is useless, she said. Well, the thing that they don't realize is if they hadn't had the vaccine, their flu may have been much, much worse. There is no vaccine for the new coronavirus yet, but the U.S. has a plan to deliver 300 million doses by January. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said a COVID-19 vaccine will not be widely available until at least the middle of next year, with the vaccines first going to the most vulnerable population, according to a report from the Washington Post. Once again, stopping there in this article and moving to our next. Health expert Peter Hotez warns of a third COVID-19 wave, says a vaccine likely won't come for another year. Vaccine expert Dr. Peter Hotez warned Texas could face another potentially deadly spike in COVID-19 cases and said an immunization for the novel coronavirus likely won't be available for another year during a conversation on Thursday at the 2020 Texas Tribune Festival. Hotez, dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, criticized the White House's lack of a coordinated response to the coronavirus, pointing to a drastic surge in cases in Texas, Georgia, and Florida this summer. If we had had that leadership that put in place a national campaign strategy to prevent the resurgence of COVID-19, we never would have been there, he said. At its peak in July, Texas logged more than 10,000 new cases of COVID-19 per day. Hospitals neared capacity and open beds in intensive care units were sparse. Now, new hospitalizations have fallen and the state is reporting about 3,500 new cases per day. But Hotez predicts another surge in Texas and across the nation this fall as students return to schools and colleges and states loosen restrictions on businesses. We could have a resurgence, a third peak, that's potentially worse than the one we just went through, he said. Even as Texans face yet another wave of the coronavirus, Hotez said a vaccine likely will not be widely available until the third quarter of 2021. Three U.S. companies are currently in the third phase of clinical trials and are expected to have enough data to determine efficacy by the end of the year. Hotez warned, communication between drug companies and the public is vital to a successful rollout, particularly amid growing public distrust of a potential vaccine. President Donald Trump said he expects a vaccine to be ready before November 3rd, a claim widely disputed by scientists. A recent Axios Ipsos poll found that 6 in 10 Americans say they would not take a COVID-19 vaccine as soon as it is available. We're going to need an unprecedented level of communication, which we don't have right now, unfortunately, Hotez said. He said he has a high level of confidence in the science of the vaccine, but worries public misconceptions could derail the process. Now, here is a series of reports from CNN. U.S. still in first COVID-19 wave and should be prepared for challenge of fall and winter, Fauci says. The U.S. remains in the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, since cases never declined significantly to a good baseline, said Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's leading infectious disease expert. The idea of a second wave is based on the pattern seen during the 1918 pandemic, when cases were seen in the spring and then cases literally disappeared before there was an explosion of cases in the fall, Fauci said. Rather than say a second wave, why don't we say, are we prepared for the challenge of the fall and winter? Fauci said. That challenge could include surges of COVID-19 cases across the country as more fronts open up, including the many schools and colleges nationwide that have welcomed students back to class. And as the weather gets cooler, more gatherings will move inside, where the virus can spread more easily. There's also a potentially complicated flu season on its way that could pile on top of the pandemic and quickly overwhelm the healthcare system. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention director has warned it could be a historically difficult fall and winter. Across the U.S., more than 6.9 million people have already been infected with the virus. CDC director Dr. Robert Redfield said this week more than 90% of the population remains susceptible to the virus. At least 202,000 Americans have died. As of early Friday morning, 23 states across the country's heartland and Midwest reported an increase of new cases compared to the previous week, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. About 16 states were trekking steady. 11 states saw a decline: Arizona, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Vermont, and Virginia. How to prepare. Cities, counties, and states that have managed to bring their COVID-19 cases down should now work to prevent surges that will inevitably occur if you're not doing the kinds of public health measures that we're talking about, according to Fauci. Those measures include what experts have for months vouched for: face coverings, hand washing, and avoiding crowds. About 12 states are now seeing mask usage rates above 50%, according to researchers from the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME. Those include California, Colorado, Florida, Maryland, Mississippi, New Jersey, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Texas, Virginia, Washington, and West Virginia. The IHME projects if 95% of Americans wore masks, more than 95,000 lives could be saved by January. And there's another tool that can make the next months easier: the flu shot. The U.S. has ordered about 200 million doses of that vaccine, Fauci said, the highest amount officials have ever tried to vaccinate. Public health officials say fewer people battling the flu this year will lessen that burden on healthcare professionals that are also trying to treat COVID-19 patients. If we listen to the public health measures, not only would we diminish the effect of COVID-19, we might get away with a very, very light flu season if we combine that with getting the flu vaccine, Fauci said. Skepticism of COVID-19 vaccine, an enormous problem. While vaccines for COVID-19 are being tested, the growing skepticism around them is becoming an enormous problem, according to Dr. William Schaffner, a professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. It's a problem, Schaffner says, because once we do develop a vaccine, obviously we want people to accept it. But there's growing skepticism in the general population. U.S. health experts have previously said it's likely many Americans will opt out of getting the COVID-19 vaccine once one is widely available. Over the summer, former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy told CNN if a vaccine was available, half of all Americans wouldn't get it because of a lack of trust. And now, 62% of Americans believe political pressure from the Trump administration will cause the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to rush approval of a COVID-19 vaccine before Election Day, according to a new health tracking poll from the Kaiser Family Foundation. If a COVID-19 vaccine was ready and available for free before the upcoming election, just 54% of respondents said they would not get one, and about 42% said they would. Fauci said Thursday he would back scientists at the FDA on whatever their decision is regarding approving a COVID-19 vaccine or giving it an emergency use authorization. These are respected, trained people who are much better at models and statistics and all that other stuff than any of us are, he said during an online conversation with CNN chief medical correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta, organized by Emory University. If you look at it and say, we feel strongly we should go this way, I would back the scientists. I would have to do that as a scientist, and I would express that. Now here's an interesting article from CNN that goes deeper into a subject that our previous article touched on: what the 1918 flu pandemic can teach us about coronavirus. At this point in the coronavirus pandemic, with more than 32 million infected and more than 980,000 dead worldwide, describing this time as unprecedented may sound like nails on a chalkboard. This pandemic, however, isn't actually without precedent. The last time we dealt with a pandemic so mysterious, uncontained, and far-reaching was in 1918, when influenza devastated populations around the globe. The 1918 flu killed 50 million to 100 million people through 1919. There are eerie parallels between the 1918 flu and the 2020 coronavirus pandemic, a disease with a startling range of symptoms for which there is little treatment, human behavior as a hindrance to public health, and cluster outbreaks that have become widespread, to name a few. For 102 years, influenza scholars and infectious disease experts have attempted to educate the masses in hopes of preventing future pandemics, and yet, here we are. To be clear, the coronavirus at fault for the current pandemic isn't a flu virus, and yet the 1918 and 2020 pandemics share similarities in terms of their basis on a novel, formidable virus that took the world and every aspect of society by storm. To learn the lessons of the 1918 flu, the missteps we've taken since, and our post-pandemic future, CNN spoke with three experts on the subject. They are John M. Barry, author of The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History; Dr. Jeremy Brown, an emergency care physician and author of Influenza, The 100-Year Hunt to Cure the Deadliest Disease in History; and Gina Colotta, a science and medicine reporter with the New York Times and author of Flu, The Story of the Great Influenza Pandemic of 1918 and the Search for the Virus that Caused It. These conversations have been edited and condensed for clarity. CNN, what are the lessons of the 1918 pandemic? John M. Barry. Number one, tell the truth. Number two, non-pharmaceutical interventions work. The Asian countries, New Zealand, Germany, and Senegal have done an incredibly good job because of transparency. But we've demonstrated you can actually control the outbreak if you do the non-pharmaceutical interventions, social distancing and masks. In the United States, we haven't done them. We haven't adhered to them. We've played with them. Dr. Jeremy Brown. There was a backlash against the wearing of masks in San Francisco in late 1918 and early 1919. People essentially were fed up. There was a group of libertarians who suggested that it was a breach of their rights and freedoms to be forced to wear masks, and actually ended up preventing the Board of Health there from renewing a mandate to wear masks. What happened was another spike in San Francisco in influenza cases in early 1919, and they went back to wearing masks. The message is, perhaps, that things are not as novel as they might seem, and that human behavior in response to pandemics of this magnitude is actually fairly predictable. Gina Colotta. Even though we know exactly what the 1918 virus looks like, we still don't know why it was so deadly. And here we have the coronavirus, and we know so much more, and we still don't really know why it's so deadly or what it's doing. I think that's a very powerful lesson that you can think, I know molecular biology. I know about viruses. I know how they replicate. And still, there can be these diseases that you do not understand. Experts on 1918 and infectious diseases have stressed heeding history to prevent future pandemics. Where do you think we've gone wrong since the 1918 flu? Brown. We have to be very careful saying, well, it was obvious, do this, do that. But I think it was fairly clear that the next pandemic threat was going to be a virus and not a bacteria, fungus, or parasite. Most people thought that it would be an influenza pandemic, and I was one of them. What I think we needed to do to spend more time on was actually considering that it could be influenza and other things. It doesn't really matter, because If we had put enough pre-planning into how we would handle an influenza pandemic, we would also have in place a game plan for how we would handle a pandemic from another virus. Unfortunately, we know that funding for these things comes in waves. Funding money is allotted based on essentially what's going on today. There's very little attention paid to what may happen down the road, and we've become complacent with our belief that we have the ability to control everything. We're all subject to the great extremes of weather, but also nature. Had we kept the pandemic planning front and center, then we would, I think, have been in a much, much better place. But each year that you fund pandemic planning, you're saying no to funding something else. When there is no pandemic on the horizon, it's very easy to say, why don't we take these many millions of dollars and put them into curing Alzheimer's disease? CNN. How did the 1918 pandemic eventually end, and how do you think the current pandemic will subside? Brown. The 1918 influenza petered out toward the beginning of 1919. Today, the influenza viruses that circulate include a descendant of that initial 1918 H1N1 virus. So we are actually exposed to a descendant of that initial pandemic. Generally speaking, infectious disease ends when people run away from it until it goes away, and when all those people who are exposed to it have died from it, so there is nobody else. And when other people who are exposed survive and achieve immunity, which gives you some protection. We've seen those three effects through history in 1918, and we will see some of that variant today. There's no doubt that we will see an end to COVID-19. The big question is, what will be the cost, and when will that be? CNN. Given what you know about the 1918 flu, what are you particularly worried about right now? Barry. The thing that's most disturbing would be that we know the virus does damage to the heart and lungs, even if people have no symptoms whatsoever. It probably damages other organs, even in people who have no symptoms. So we don't know the long-term effects, whether that damage is going to heal, and whether it will haunt them and affect their lives 10 or 25 years from now. Brown. I'm most worried about the selfishness of people and this thought that, if I'm okay, that's all that matters. I think that the message we've seen is that people are selfish to a remarkable degree that I don't think we've seen before. The selfishness of people and their inability to have empathy for others who aren't like themselves is one of the very, very worrying aspects that the disease has highlighted. I think this is a deeply rooted part of American society. Colada. I worry about society, employment, people who've lost everything, and people who don't have enough to eat. I'm worried about the kids in school because remote learning does not work, and college kids who have to go to college remotely. People who just graduated can't get jobs. They're sort of like a lost generation when they should be starting their careers. I worry about people who are long haulers. They just sort of never recover. I worry about people who lose family members. CNN. Is there anything about the current pandemic that gives you hope? Barry. Trump is right about one thing. This virus won't disappear. It's going to be here forever. But I think eventually people's immune systems will adjust to it with or without a vaccine. It probably won't be as dangerous in the future as it is now. At least there's a good chance of that. Brown. First of all, people seem to get back to normality very quickly. Now, I think that's because infectious disease was such a common occurrence at the turn of the century. We had no vaccines against diphtheria, measles, hepatitis, or meningitis, so waves of these diseases were very common in Europe and the United States. People have been dealing with infectious diseases in their lives for centuries. In 1918, they bounced back relatively quickly. With COVID-19, I think it remains an open question as to whether there will be an economic bounce back, and more importantly, an emotional bounce back, where we are reminded in ways that we've never been reminded before that we are subject to the whims of nature when it comes to diseases. Colada. Societies have somehow come through, recovered, and survived some pretty horrible pandemics in the past that were much worse than we're going through right now. Now, at least, we have a chance of getting a vaccine that might actually stop this virus before it runs through the entire population and affects everybody that could be affected. So, I have some hope. Now, here's an article published yesterday in the Washington Post. The pandemic pushes hundreds of millions of people toward starvation and poverty. Financiers and traders on Wall Street may be starting to feel optimistic, but for most people, the gloom is only deepening. In the United States, thousands of people continue to die of COVID-19 each week, while some 30 million people remain unemployed. Industrial output and consumer spending are still well below pre-pandemic levels, with experts pointing to evidence of spiraling inequality as winter approaches. In Europe, a second surge of infections has triggered warnings and shutdowns, compounding the continent's economic jitters. Yet the worst pain is centered in the developing world. In recent weeks, a host of international organizations and agencies have sounded alarms over crises provoked by the novel coronavirus. While many Western governments manage to hold the line through stimulus programs, poorer nations are floundering amid massive public debt and shortfalls in state revenue. All the while, the roughly 2 billion people who eke out a living in the world's informal economies face varying degrees of deprivation. David Beasley, the executive director of the UN's World Food Program, warned during a September 18th briefing that a wave of hunger and famine still threatens to sweep across the globe. He said his organization needed close to $5 billion to prevent 30 million people from dying of starvation. According to the agency, some 135 million people around the world faced acute food insecurity before the pandemic, and that number is expected to double this year. The World Bank says the pandemic may undermine international efforts to bring down the global extreme poverty rate to 3% by 2030, and projects that existing poverty levels will grow this year for the first time since the 1990s. Some 160 million people in Asia alone may be forced below the poverty line, according to the Asian Development Bank. In Latin America, that figure is around 45 million people, according to a recent UN study. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, calculated that 872 million students in 51 countries are unable to head back to their classrooms. More than half that number live in circumstances where remote learning is impossible, a scale that suggests a generational crisis in education. As hospitals and clinics around the world remain swamped, UNICEF fears new declines in infant and maternal health. When children are denied access to health services because the system is overrun, and when women are afraid to give birth at the hospital for fear of infection, they too may become casualties of COVID-19. Henrietta Fore, UNICEF's executive director, said in a statement, "Without urgent investments to restart disrupted health systems and services, millions of children under five, especially newborns, could die." Campaigners who have led the charge to reach the UN's poverty-eradicating sustainable development goals warned of an epochal reversal. "We have celebrated decades of historic progress in fighting poverty and disease," wrote Bill and Melinda Gates in their foundation's annual Goalkeepers report. "But we have to confront the current reality with candor. This progress has now stopped." Even with the $18 trillion of stimulus pumped into the global economy, mostly by wealthy governments, the International Monetary Fund projects a cumulative loss of some $12 trillion by the end of 2021. A separate study from the International Labor Organization, a Geneva-based UN body, found that the pandemic has already wiped out $3.5 trillion in income from millions of workers around the world. By the ILO's calculations, projected global working hour losses in 2020 will be the equivalent of some 245 million lost jobs. Some of the worst-hit places are in countries that cannot afford such setbacks. India's economic output shrank by 24% in the past 3 months to June, compared to the same period last year, worse than any other major economy. My colleagues Neha Mashish and Joanna Slater wrote in a report on Indian university graduates scrambling for meager wages through a government-run rural labor program. During the nationwide lockdown, more than 120 million jobs were lost, most of them in the country's vast informal sector. Many of those workers have returned to work out of sheer necessity, often scraping by on far lower wages. In Latin America, the economic disaster may be just as acute, if not more so. Leading UN officials warned of a lost decade in the region with spiking poverty and entrenched recessions. The ILO pointed to a stimulus gap between rich and poor countries. Just as we need to redouble our efforts to beat the virus, so we need to act urgently and at scale to overcome its economic, social, and employment impacts, Guy Ryder, the ILO Secretary General, said in a statement. That includes sustaining support for jobs, businesses, and incomes. But it's unclear how much more wealthy governments are willing to give in the face of their own budget crunches. Developing countries have been exposed to manifold shocks in a context of anemic global growth. Stephanie Blankenberg, the head of debt and development finance at the UN Conference on Trade and Development, told the Financial Times, "The international response has been extraordinarily hesitant, way too little, way too late." The focus may have to fall on private donors. Worldwide, there are over 2,000 billionaires with a net worth of $8 trillion. In my home country, the USA, there are 12 individuals alone worth $1 trillion, said Beasley of WFP. In fact, reports state that three of them made billions upon billions during COVID. I am not opposed to people making money, but humanity is facing the greatest crisis any of us have seen in our lifetimes. Now we're going to conclude our day with a couple of pre-recorded reports. The first is from Austin-based opinion writer Ross Ramsey, whose column regularly appears in the Midland Reporter Telegram. Here he narrates his own column from today. Analysis: Coronavirus splits Texas Governor Greg Abbott and his own party.
This is Ross Ramsey from the Texas Tribune. Today's column: Coronavirus splits Texas Governor Greg Abbott and his own party. Governor Greg Abbott's most exasperating allies sure chose an awkward time to act up. In the face of a momentous election with an array of issues that includes the pandemic, the recession, climate change, racial justice, law enforcement, and the next appointment to the United States Supreme Court, the chairman of the Texas GOP and a gang of lawmakers and activists have instead picked a fight with Abbott, who isn't even on the ballot, over his response to the pandemic. On the surface, they're asking the courts to tell the governor that adding 6 more days of early voting to the calendar was outside of his powers. Abbott made the move under emergency powers he has claimed during the pandemic, the same powers he has used at various times to shut down schools, limit crowd sizes, and limit how many customers businesses can serve at a time, or in some cases, to close businesses altogether. The timing is connected to the November 3rd general election, even with the arguments over emergency powers. Opponents of the governor's action would be expected to grab for a remedy before early voting starts on October 13th. One might say the same about other lawsuits challenging the governor's orders, that they're tied not to politics but to current events. Bar owners want to open their bars, for instance, and are not in the financial condition or the mood to stay closed until after the elections just to make the current set of incumbents look good. What's unusual is to see so many prominent Republican names on the top of a lawsuit against the Republican governor of Texas this close to an election. In a gentler time, that might be called unseemly or distracting. Speaking ill of another Republican was considered out of bounds for a while there. Those days are over. What's happening in Texas illustrates how the pandemic, the economy, and other issues have shaken political norms. Shelley Luther is one of six people running in a special election to replace State Senator Pat Fallon, a prosper Republican who gave up his state house perch for a shot at a congressional seat. Abbott doesn't have a hand in that race, but his name is being invoked. Luther is the Dallas area salon owner who was briefly jailed this year after defying Abbott's orders closing businesses like hers that were officially deemed non-essential. So maybe it's not a surprise that she campaigns as a candidate who's independent of her party leader. She started the game playing the renegade card and has stuck with it. But she's not alone out there. Some of the state's most conservative Republicans, part of Abbott's base of support over his decades in state government, are taking the governor to task. State Representative Steve Toth, a Republican from the Woodlands, has disowned Abbott, saying he can no longer follow the GOP's leading state official. What started as 15 days to flatten the curve has turned into 6 months of misery to the small business owners of House District 15, Toth wrote in a letter to Abbott that he later posted on social media. He said Abbott had demonstrated an appalling lack of consistency, leadership, and concern for small businesses. That's the kind of chippy note from one politician to another that you would expect to read in the last few weeks before a big election. But this election has no direct bearing on either of those politicians. Toth is running as a Republican in a House district where Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 37.2 percentage points, and where Ted Cruz beat Beto O'Rourke by 29.8 percentage points. It's safe to say he's safe in the general election, unless he steps into an open manhole crossing the street. Abbott, elected to a second term in 2018, isn't on the ballot this year. The election is near. Unless the courts change it, early voting starts in less than 3 weeks. Democrats and Republicans are shouting at each other as the season demands. In a normal presidential election year, a Texas governor who isn't on the ballot would be leading the partisan charge, helping lesser and greater figures rally their voters in the state. Abbott isn't ignoring the political fights of the season, but there is an extra one this year in his own political family.
And now for our final report for the week, here is one of our favorite segments from the Texas Standard. Ask a Doctor. A UT Health San Antonio physician answers listeners' questions about their health during the coronavirus pandemic.
Throughout the pandemic, we've been getting your questions answered and soliciting advice related to the coronavirus from Dr. Fred Campbell. He is a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It's good to be with you, David.
So we're going to start today by trying to get some clarification on instructions from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. There's been some confusing guidance from the CDC of late regarding how the virus spreads through the air. The agency posted on Friday that the coronavirus, and I want to quote here, could spread through airborne transmission between people more than 6 feet apart, then remove that guidance on Monday. So what is the most up-to-date information on this, Doctor?
It's very fortunate that there has been a recent extensive review published in the Annals of Internal Medicine on infectivity with COVID-19. So I can feel pretty comfortable about these recommendations, as opposed to an emphasis on aerosol particles, which are the ones that spread widely. Mm-hmm. It appears that that is a very unusual way of transmitting COVID-19, with rare exceptions. There was a choir church situation where it might have happened, but otherwise the 6-foot distance is still considered to be an extremely effective recommendation.
The likelihood that you're going to get an infection from such a scenario is extremely rare, even though there might have been one instance of it that's medically recognized. Is that right?
That is correct. Those aerosols do contain virus particles, but for whatever reason, they don't appear to be infectious.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Now, let's move on to the next question, which comes to us from an anonymous listener who asks, Is it clear how HVAC systems influence COVID particle movement in an enclosed environment, like a school? In other words, if a carrier is breathing out particles in one room, can they be transported to a different room through the building's air ducts? What do you say?
There has been a lot of discussion, particularly in airline travel, mm-hmm. about the idea of filtering and recycling air. To my knowledge, there have been absolutely zero studies to talk about infectivity with those kinds of situations. And the HVAC, although it could very well move particles around, particularly the aerosolized particles, again, as we spoke about earlier, I think that the infectivity rate among the studies that have been looked at have been extremely low with that kind of transmission.
So extremely low liability that you're going to catch COVID because of someone in a different room and particles going through the air ducts. Extremely low possibility.
I think that the data supports that completely.
In Austin, listener Michael has this question. We know that it's much harder to spread the virus outdoors than inside. That's what the experts say. But what about, here's another scenario, in a garage with the door open, is that a suitable environment for small gatherings, or is it just as bad as being inside a structure, to your opinion?
No, I do not believe it is as bad as being indoors. Ventilation is extremely important in an enclosed space, and a garage would be as close to an outside environment as one could get. So a large ventilation like a garage door would provide a significant amount of protection. Of course, has to be coupled with the 6-foot social distancing and wearing of the mask, but that would be a preferred situation to an indoor closed up environment.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because you know, I've noticed, and maybe you've seen this too, I've noticed like small, what appear to be sort of, I don't want to say block parties, but it appears like neighbors gathering outside a friend's house just to have that human touch, right? And they're sitting in lawn chairs, maybe outside a garage or partially inside a garage. How risky is that sort of thing?
Well, we're again talking about percentages. Nothing is 100%, but the review of the studies having to do with outdoor activities leads to an incredibly low infectivity rate among virtually all of the studies that I've looked at.
So on balance, we should feel pretty safe about those situations so long as we're maintaining social distance. Should we still use our masks? Do we need to still use our masks in that sort of thing?
With the exception of long periods very close together outside or not wearing masks, otherwise people can feel really comfortable about those outdoor distancing events.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine over at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health, San Antonio. We have been having him on regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. And so if you have something you would like us to ask the good doctor, you can look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for your advice. We certainly do appreciate it.
And that is your coronavirus
update for this Friday, September 25th, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up next, we'll bring you the national news with USA Today, followed by local news at 3 o'clock. Here are a few of today's articles that our volunteers will be reading. From the Midland Reporter Telegram, MISD updates students return to campus. Elementary school students can return full-time by October 5th. Secondary students on November 9th. Hospital CEO encouraged by lack of Labor Day bump. Midland Online Academy will be overhauled. And from the Odessa American, former OCA teacher charged and booked. Boone posts bail totaling $150,000. Library clerk shares her love of books. And Doctor Talks Positivity Rate. Those articles and more coming up at 3 o'clock from our local papers. And then at 6, of course, we'll bring you the Wall Street Journal. A reminder that on Fridays at 7, we have the On the Lighter Side program, which kind of takes a lighter look at everything from humorous writers and more. On the Lighter Side at 7 o'clock tonight to kind of wrap up the week on more of a fun note. Thank you, as always, for joining us. As we do on Fridays, we're going to leave you with some music. This week, Wednesday. Bruce Springsteen turned 71. How is that possible? So we'll wrap up with a song from The Boss, Dancing in the Dark. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday.
I get up in the evening and I ain't got nothing.